I'm Denise, I'm the Scottish one.
And she's a non-fiction editor.
And I'm Louise, the English one.
And she's a fiction editor. And together,
we're the Other Thing Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to this episode of the Editing Podcast.
Hello. So we're delighted to welcome a friend from over the pond, Tim Storm. Welcome, Tim. It's lovely to have you here with us. Tell us about what you do and where you're from.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. I am, first of all, a big fan of the Editing Podcast.
Oh, thank you.
But I'm also a writer, teacher, and editor. I work mostly with fiction these days, but I've done a lot of teaching and editing and personal essays, and I've edited some textbooks and the occasional academic paper. And I hail from Madison, Wisconsin, which is a mid-sized city about 2.5 hours drive northwest of Chicago.
All right, northwest of Chicago. That means it must be cold there now, surely.
It is.
Colder than we've got
really?
Here.
Really? Yeah.
Tim, sorry. You've kindly agreed to come on and talk to us about the concept of editing unearned writing, which I have to confess is something that I wasn't familiar with.
Yeah, and Tim, when I first heard you use that term, I didn't get it either, even though I'm a fiction editor, but I think essentially we're talking about plausibility, though I really like your way of expressing it because it feels like it asks a little bit more from a writer, a sort of responsibility, if you like. So tell us more.
Yeah, I really like that word responsibility for this because there's this sense that we owe it to readers to get this right. I would explain the concept of earning as having to do with story events. For fiction, has to do with story events and character reactions. And for nonfiction, has to do with ideas and arguments. And earning is really just a matter of feeling natural and logical and consistent with those story events, reactions, arguments. And this isn't to say that you can't surprise us. It just means that there needs to be a sort of retrospective plausibility. Like when we look back at the story prior to the moment in question, the event or reaction should feel almost inevitable.
Right. That makes sense. Yeah.
Yeah, it really is a matter of plausibility, but it's causality and logic. And I like to make this subtle distinction between an event or reaction being logical and coming about logically. Because even if a character is irrational or illogical, and they often are because that's kind of true to human nature, right? Readers need to see where that's coming from. And if I may put a finer point on it, plausibility is a concern here, but this is also about authenticity. I think it was W.H. Auden who said something about how writers worry too much about originality when it's really authenticity they should be worried about.
Yeah, that's
a good one.
And what's fun about this is that nonfiction and fiction, what they have in common is truth. They're different approaches to truth and to conveying the truth, but they are both after truth. And if a writer can't create a story event or character reaction or argument or explanation that arises out of the words that precede that moment in the piece of writing, then it won't feel true. It won't feel authentic. And that's why there's really a responsibility to get this right.
That makes a lot of sense. It's I think you've articulated that really well, Tim.
Really good.
Yeah, because just following the logic of what you were saying, can see absolutely how that fits both in fiction and in nonfiction. And I know that we're going to chat a little bit about this in nonfiction a bit later, but let's just stick with the fiction for now. When you're editing, are there particular types of this unearned writing that you tend to see more often?
Yeah, and it would be really helpful if perhaps you could give us an example with each, either from books or TV or film, so that listeners can really get their heads around this issue of plausibility and responsibility.
Sure. Yeah, there are a few types I see often. The first and most common, I would say, is probably about salvation events. Those are moments in the story when a character gets out of trouble.
Yeah.
This is like the classic Deus Ex Machina, which... For any listeners who maybe aren't familiar with it, it means God from the machine. And it harkens back to like Greek theater when the hero would be in trouble and it would seem that all was hopeless in the end. And then a god would suddenly appear on the stage, usually lowered from some sort of contraption or machine, and then would save this hero and all would end happily.
Right. Yeah.
But I think they recognized even then that this was lazy writing.
It is. It's a bit of a cop-out, isn't it?
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. And for me, one of my favorite examples is from Jurassic Park, right. The film. It's been so long since I've read the book. I don't remember if the book does this, but in the film, we've got the protagonists, Alan, Ellie, Lex, and Timmy, and they're all running away from velociraptors. And they end up in like the lobby, I think, of the Welcome Center at Jurassic Park, surrounded by three velociraptors, and all seems hopeless. But then a T-Rex, which up until this point in the film, every time a T-Rex has appeared, like the earth shakes, right? But now, like out of nowhere, this T-Rex appears and decides to pick a fight exclusively with the velociraptors and allows the humans to run out of the lobby. And then they hitch a ride on a Jeep that very conveniently shows up right at that moment.
Those Jeeps, they just do that, don't they?
Those Jeeps, yes.
That was a T-Rex obviously tiptoeing at that point.
Yeah.
The crux of the problem here really has to do with the salvation doesn't arise from a character choice in any way. It's just random good luck.
Yeah, and that's... that can be sort of frustrating, can't it? I do remember that scene, and it does feel like, I said, it does feel like the writers have kind of just copped out a little bit. And maybe you can get away with that in a Hollywood blockbuster, but I don't think it's the best approach for a writer who's trying to gain trust with their audience, especially perhaps if it's their first book. Yeah, would you say absolutely. The same?
Yeah, exactly. And then the other thing is, I was just looking up that Jurassic Park, the film came out in 93 and the book came out in 90.
Mm-hmm.
So it's 30 years old. And, you know, I think writers nowadays, it really, like, publishing is a tougher landscape. And I don't think you can't afford to have something that's not really high quality, you know?
Yeah, there's too much competition in the market, isn't there?
Exactly.
It's not just, you know, even for people who are going it alone and doing their own self-publishing, they're competing with each other, but there's also some so much advice and guidance on how to get this stuff right, and so many books out there and that highlight what, you know, this, the kind of teaching that's available that highlights these kind of problems, that I think readers are a bit more savvy than they used to be.
Yeah, I was about to say, I think readers expect more. I think they're more discerning perhaps now, because it's so easy to put a book to one side if you're not convinced by it. Mm. I think people are much more likely just to put it down and move on to something else.
That's a really good point, Denise, actually, because you think about, like, you know, if you've got a load of books on your Kindle or your iPad or whatever, it's just too easy to click away from it. Whereas, you know, that's not quite the same situation as if you're sitting on your couch or whatever and you've actually got your paperback in front of you. So many people are using digital devices now that it's dead easy if you're bored just to go elsewhere.
But, you know, I would say even, I know this is getting off the point slightly, but it's not even just the fact that it's digital. I have got so many amazing books sitting waiting to be read that I'm not going to
waste time on a rubbish one or
work hard to make a book believable if I don't feel that it is. So even with, you know, hard copy books, I'm much more inclined nowadays than I ever was before to put something to one side if it's not holding me and convincing me of the story.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's part of the argument here, is that earning events is really about sort of gaining and holding the reader's trust, right?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah. The another type I see often is about character realizations. It's that moment in a romance, like when the character realizes she loves and has sort of subconsciously always loved her college classmate. Or it's like even a simpler sort of scene level realization, someone realizing suddenly that everyone around her is looking at her for answers, or even just someone realizing that they're lost, either literally or figuratively. A realization is a reevaluation of a notion. And to realize means you've moved through a few stages. And I see it as stage one is kind of you believe the opposite of the realization, i.e. that you're not lost.
Mm-hmm.
Step two is that you subconsciously become aware that previous notion is wrong. And then step three is that the truth kind of rises to conscious awareness. So a realization can seem sudden, but it's often something that builds. And the most common problem I see is that writers rush realizations.
That's really interesting, that thing about rushing, because it might be that I wonder if sometimes it's because the author's so invested in the story that it seems like in their head, the foundations have been built because they're in that writer's head. They know those characters intimately. They know their backstories and they know where the story's going, but the reader's coming to it fresh. So that sudden realization really jars with the reader. It just doesn't quite add up.
Yeah, that's it for sure. Yeah, I mean, it's really tricky to look at your own work over and over again as you're revising and then to keep in mind how someone reading for the first time is perceiving it, right?
Yeah. Mm.
And they don't, and the thing about the realizations is that, and I'm guilty of this too, especially in early drafts, is you don't allow time for the realization to sort of bubble up from the subconscious to conscious awareness for the character.
Yeah.
So is that a sort of a pacing thing as well about how information is released to the reader as well? I don't work with fiction, but that, it seems to me it's like how and when you release that information to the reader or allow them to work out these realizations, it has to be done in a way that feels logical, as you were saying before, and it isn't a sudden an about turn for somebody to suddenly change their position on something or come to a realization.
Yeah, definitely.
Tim, can I ask you something? I mean, does that sort of factor into outlining? Because I was just listening to something the other day and the author was talking about their outlining pro. It was a very famous author. It's like someone like James Patterson or something. And he was talking about the really detailed outlining. I mean, that's not everybody's approach. Some people pants it, but he does really deep outlining. And he was talking about this sort of process of making, you know, actually sort of working at that revision stage to make sure, even before he starts crafting the sentences, to make sure that rushing doesn't happen, that the foundations are in place and that the reveal, the big reveal, is paced and or structured so that it works for the reader. Do you feel that's therefore more likely to be a problem that's going to arise for writers who don't outline? Or
That's a good question. Yeah, I don't know. I do see it. There is definitely an issue here with the sort of larger story just conceptually sometimes. The thing about like pantsing the you know, doing the seat of your pants approach and just sort of feeling out the story, sometimes that has better believability and plausibility because you're so in the scene and the next scene is just dependent on what came before it and you're open to kind of anything. Whereas the plotters sometimes figure, well, no, I need to reach this plot point. And so here it is and I'm going to force it in, but it doesn't necessarily feel organic or earned. But I can see it. I mean, it's a challenge. There's a challenge for both methods.
Okay.
I think. And in fact, I mean, I think the next problem I see often is with plot turns. So it's that more conceptual level. And by this, I just mean when there's a surprising turn of events. You know, if we have like a problem arise all of a sudden, there's no issue with that. Like a problem can come up out of nowhere and it can just be bad luck. For whatever reason, bad luck is totally plausible, whereas good luck is a little less.
That's true, actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
But if a story turns on character decision or discovery of new information, I often end up scrutinizing whether that decision or discovery is earned. Mm-hmm. So one example, here's a common challenge that I see. Let's say you're writing a short story or a scene, and this is about Tom and his son Noah. And Noah's 11, and when he turns 12, Tom is going to take him on a trip for like a hunting or fishing trip or something.
Yeah.
But then on the eve of his son's birthday, Tom decides not to take him. And in the morning, Noah wakes up excited to go, but Tom tells him no. And that's kind of our skeletal plot of the story, right? And maybe you discover that through pantsing it or planning it out ahead of time. Now, if we're going to tell the story from Tom's point of view, we need to know why he decided not to take Noah on the trip.
Yep.
And, yeah. And that's what I'm talking about here is like the whole point, the whole plot turns on this character decision not to go, and that decision can't be random.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
If we're to tell it, it would be different if we were to tell it from Noah's point of view, because then it's not a decision, it's a problem, right?
Yep.
He doesn't understand why his dad decided this. It just, that's the new problem for him. But if we're telling from Tom's point of view, it's sort of obligatory that we know why he made that decision.
Mm. Yeah.
Yeah. That randomness then is a bit like the Jeep in Jurassic Park turning up. But in this case, now we're deeper in the character's head. So it can't be too convenient. Is that right?
Maybe feels a bit too contrived.
Yeah. 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 That's very much the case when it comes to discoveries, too.
Mm-hmm.
You have to watch out for convenient or contrived discoveries.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reading the third Harry Potter book to my daughter right now, and we're in that scene where Harry discovers the truth about Peter Pettigrew. And I don't think this will spoil anything for anyone left who hasn't read it. But
is there anyone left?
I don't know.
Just Tim's daughter.
Yes.
My daughter, right. But there's so in that scene, so much hinges on there's so much setup necessary for that scene. We need to know information about Ron's pet rat and Sirius Black's entire backstory and Lupin's relationship with Harry's dad and other friends. And then the Potter's secret keeper and Voldemort and Hermione's cat Crookshanks. It's really, really elaborate.
Yeah.
And the scene is appropriately stretched out to sort of give us all of that. But I think any misstep there in the scene could easily have felt contrived. And so when there's a big discovery or revelation, that's something you want to think about earning because it really needs kind of proper setup.
Yeah. Yeah. Because when people go back on it, everything that has come before that point has to fit with it, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Because otherwise you just lose credibility with it if you're sort of trying to retrofix something because you didn't set it up properly. It's not going to sit well with the reader otherwise.
One thing I sometimes see when that happens with less experienced authors is that you end up with this almost an information dump. You know, it's just like this, oh my God, you know, I have to make this all work. And that's like you said, Tim, about making sure, you know, that elaboration and it's stretched out, but it needs to be. And when you've got suddenly a character just kind of like saying, oh, and by the way, it can just turn into awful maiden butler talk, actually.
Mm-hmm. But as a reader, it's wonderful when you get that sort of reveal and you can look back and everything, you see everything differently, but in a really good way. It's like, oh, that's what that was all about. And it's like you've been let in on an amazing secret that was building all the time right in front of you, but you didn't actually know until this happened. And that's really skilled plotting, isn't it?
Yeah. And it's a lot of fun to read.
Right? Mm.
Yeah. There's one other thing that I want to mention, which is thematic insertions. I see these quite a bit where say like two characters are on their way to identify a dead body. Let's say it's the estranged mother of one of them. And they have a conversation on the way about horses. And the point of view character thinks long and hard about how horse societies are matriarchal and how mares are sometimes notoriously nasty and competitive. And then we arrive at the morgue or whatever, and that's that. Now, it's not that the matriarchal horse parallel is bad. It's just that it's not finessed well enough. It's a question of how it's delivered, right?
Yeah. There's definitely a danger that it can seem just a bit like the author's trying just too hard to weave in something that's important or interesting to them, but it's really not in step with the moment in the novel. It feels really out of place. Mm. Yeah.
And sometimes I think it can sound almost like too much like the writer's holding up a signal to say, I've got an agenda, and that can come across even as a bit patronizing, but even when it's not, it can still be interruptive because as readers, we're thinking, oh my God, we're on the way to the morgue to see X's estranged mother. And now we're philosophizing about horse matriarchy, you know.
Right.
I tell you, I'll just say, Tim, for the record, that I learned something about horses today. I had no idea that this conversation was going to lead to this. So thank you for that.
I don't know what you're going to learn.
He can come on again.
Yeah.
Yeah, this obviously symbolic pondering session, that's just not the way to do it, right? To deliver this theme. You need to go for something that sort of draws less attention to itself. So for me, some of the biggest ones I see, or most common ones I see, are dreams. Like, people just sort of insert a dream that the character has that is very thematically, you know, weighted. Or another one I see often is like a piece of artwork or a book. Like, the character will be on the way to the morgue to see the mother, and on the way, like, a high school student will drop a book, and it'll be Hamlet or Oedipus Rex or As I Lay Dying, or, you know, some book where the mother is horrible, right?
Yeah.
It's just really clunky, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely.
Shouting at it, in your face with it, yeah. So, Tim, if an author's self-editing their latest draft, and maybe this is the first time they've even considered the concept of unearned writing, how would they go about it and turn that unearned into earned?
Yeah, I mean, can it be fixed at line level, or does it require, is it always a case of major restructuring? I guess I'm trying to get a sense of what the stakes are here, because it sounds to me like it could be quite drastic.
It could, yeah, that's a really good question. I think, like a lot of issues in editing, the first step is about identifying what the problem is, because some of them are big macro level issues. If you're J.K. Rowling writing The Prisoner of Azkaban, you might have some very big conceptual things you need to work out in order for that scene about Peter Pettigrew to feel earned. But there are other times when the earning is really just a matter of, you know, finessing a line or two. And I think one of the things you can do is examine what Dwight Swain calls MR units. The M is motivating stimulus, and the R is response. And so you look at those, there'll be several of those throughout the scene. The scene kind of moves in those MR units, he says. And when you look at those responses, look at, especially for your main character, they can be a little mysterious. It's okay if we don't, you know, fully understand where that's coming from right now. Mm-hmm. But is the reader prepared either right then or in the future to make sense of how that response came about?
Okay.
So I find that a pretty useful sort of self-editing exercise.
Is there a is there a book or a resource that you would urge readers to go and
dig into? Yeah, his book is it's a little older. It's called Techniques of the Selling Writer or something.
Okay.
It's not the first title that would have drawn my attention, but it's quite good, though. You know, he has, it's like many things from 60 to 70 years ago, there's some subtle misogynism throughout it and that sort of thing. So if you can excuse some of that, there's some really good advice.
We'll put it in the show. We'll put it in the show notes anyway, with your caveat.
Tim, we've talked quite a lot there about fiction, but what about nonfiction? I know you do work with that as well. Do these issues come into play here too?
Yeah, for nonfiction, I think earning is really more about earning assertions. If you're going to set out to argue, say, that self-care can be detrimental to creativity, well, that's an assertion that doesn't immediately make sense. So you're going to need to kind of walk us up the stairs to that controversial argument. And you can kind of think of this less in argument terms and more in explanation, if that's the kind of nonfiction you're writing. Because in order to adequately explain what isn't obvious, we need to see a logical path for arriving at the non-obvious statements, right?
Yeah.
So when I'm editing nonfiction, I often talk about an idea flow. How are you moving us from one idea to the next? And are you transitioning well and earning the assertions that you are laying out for us?
I think that's a really good point. I work just in nonfiction, and that idea of transitioning from one idea to the next, I think it's very easy for nonfiction writers to have isolated ideas, but it's connecting them and moving the reader from one to the other in a way that's leading them on a journey. And also the whole concept of understanding what level of knowledge the reader has at that point. I find that a big issue with nonfiction. It's that whole curse of knowledge. There are assumptions made, and therefore information isn't explained properly or given in a in an easily consumable way for the reader. So that's what I would take from that, I think.
That's such a good point, because I think when I'm learning, I mean, I think about a lot of the writing craft books that I read, you know, when there are, I've come across somewhere where I've thought, I've later come to understand what the writer was talking about. But at the time, it just seemed like this dense information dump, like there was assumptions made about my knowledge coming to the to the book in the first place, and so and the language was wrong, and there wasn't that information flow. That's a really that idea flow. It didn't take me step through step. It was like a chapter on this, a chapter on that, and I didn't feel like I was growing into the book, and so I couldn't learn from it as effectively as I might have done. It's a really good point. Tim, you've written a bit about this, haven't you?
Yeah, I have a few articles on my blog about cause and effect and writing character realizations and earning story events.
That's great. We'll make sure that links to all of these are in the show notes for our listeners to go and delve into in their own time. So now it's time for Editing Bites. This is our regular feature where we recommend a tool or resource to help you on your writing journey. So Louise, what have you got for us this week?
So this is a little tool that a colleague told me about. It's just a dinky little online thing for writers wanting to work out how to capitalise headings in works according to certain style guides. Probably a thing I think a lot of non-fiction writers would prefer or get use out of, but I see it cropping up in fiction as well sometimes. So sometimes people get in a muddle over whether to capitalize things like prepositions and conjunctions and articles in a heading, and there's this tool called Title Case Converter which does it for you. And you can choose various different style guide preferences to suit, depending on who you're publishing with or whatever. The only thing I'd say is that people using this need to take care to scroll down the page to get to the result, because I missed it the first time and thought it just wasn't working. But it was.
Just haven't gone down the page far enough.
Yeah. So what's yours? What's your bite?
Well, this week, my bite is another podcast. It's called The Illusionist. And in it, Helen Zaltzman takes a deep dive into language, along with the help of experts, listener questions and words of the day. It's absolutely fascinating. It's full of humour. And the episodes run to around the sort of 20, 30 minute mark, which is perfect for a commute or a walk around the block.
So that's it. We hope you've enjoyed this episode. Tim, you've just wowed us with amazing information. Thank you so much.
Thank you
to everybody for listening. You can rate, review and subscribe to us via Apple Podcasts, Spotify or whichever platform you prefer.
And as I said, we've put all the links in the show notes so you can grab everything there. And thank you once again, Tim, for being such a wonderful guest.
Thank you, Tim. Bye.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
Bye.